adolescence to get back at the family for some imagined slight, some favouring of Liv Waiter over her. It might have seemed like love at the time, but he suspected even she knew it was not now. He believed that Darkance really was an unwilling hostage. Many people had been taken by surprise when Alethiamel attacked the city. Just the speed of the advance had trapped half the population, and Darkance had been unlucky to be discovered trying to leave from the chaos of the airport. Alethiamel had had agents out looking for her. So for her, he had to go on fighting, even if he had almost worn away the hate in his heart for Alethiamel. The hate that had kept him fighting these last years, but now was running out, just worn down by the abrading course of the long war. How could Alethiamel do it? Even if he didn't still love her, and the monster claimed that Liv Waiter was his real desire, how could he use her like another shell stored in the battleship's cavernous magazines? And what was he supposed to do in reply? Use Liv Waiter against Alethiamel? Attempt the same level of cunning cruelty? Already, Liv Waiter blamed him, not Alethiamel, for all that had happened. What was he supposed to do? Surrender? Barter sister for sister? Mount some mad, doomed rescue attempt? Simply attack? He had tried to explain that only a prolonged siege guaranteed success, but argued about it so often now that he was starting to wonder if he was right. Sir! He turned, looked at the dim figures of the commanders behind him. What? He snapped. Sir! It was Swales. Sir, perhaps we should be setting off now, back to headquarters. The cloud is breaking from the east and it will be dawn soon. We shouldn't be caught in range. I know that, he said. He glanced out at the dark outline of the Stabarind and felt himself flinch a little, as though he expected its huge guns to belch flame right there and then, straight at him. He drew a metal shutter across the concrete slit. It was very dark in the bunker for a second. Then somebody switched on the harsh yellow lights, and they all stood there, blinking in the glare. They left the bunker. The long mass of the armoured staff car waited in the darkness. Assorted aides and junior officers leapt to attention, straightened caps, saluted and opened doors. He climbed into the car, sitting on the fur-covered rear bench, watching as three of the other commanders followed, sitting in a line opposite him. The armoured door clanged shut. The car growled and moved, bumping over the uneven ground and back into the forest, away from the dark shape resting in the night behind. Sir, Swale said, exchanging looks with the other two commanders. The other commanders and I have discussed... You are going to tell me that we should attack, bomb and shell the Stabarind until it is a flaming hulk, and then storm it with troop hovers, he said, holding up one hand. I know what you've been discussing, and I know what decisions you think you've arrived at. They do not interest me. Sir, we all realise the strain you are under because your sister is held on the ship, but that has nothing to do with it, Swales, he told the other man. You insult me by implying that I even consider that a reason for holding off. My reasons are sound military reasons, and foremost of those is that the enemy has succeeded in creating a fortress that is, at the moment, almost impregnable. We must wait until the winter floods, when the fleet can negotiate the estuary and the channel, and engage the Stabarind on equal terms. To send in aircraft or attempt to engage in an artillery duel would be the height of folly. Sir, Swale said, much as we are distressed at having to disagree with you, we nevertheless... You will be silent, Commander Swales, he said icily. The other man swallowed. I have sufficient matters to worry about without having to concern myself with the drivel that passes for serious military planning between my senior officers, or, I might add, with replacing any of those senior officers. For a while, there was only the distant grumbling noise of the car engine. Swales looked shocked. The other two commanders were staring at the rug floor. Swales's face looked shiny. He swallowed again. The voice of the labouring car seemed to emphasise the silence in the rear compartment as the four men were jostled and shaken. Then the car found a metalled road and roared off, pressing him back in the seat, making the other three sway towards him before sitting back again. Sir, I am ready to leave. Must this go on? He complained, hoping to stop Swales. Can't you lift even this small burden from me? All I ask is that you do as you ought. Let there be no disagreement. Let us fight the enemy, not amongst ourselves. to leave your staff if you so wish," Swales continued. Now it was as though the noise of the engine did not intrude inside the passenger cell at all. A frozen silence, held not in the air, but in the expression of Swales's face and the still, tensed bodies of the other two commanders, seemed to settle over the four, like some prescient breath of a winter that was still half a year away. He wanted to close his eyes, but could not show such weakness. He kept his gaze fixed on the man directly across from him.
"Sir, I have to tell you that I disagree with the course you are pursuing, and I am not alone. Sir, please believe me that I and the other commanders love you as we love our country with all our hearts. But because of that love, we cannot stand by while you throw away everything you stand for and all we believe in, trying to defend a mistaken decision."
He saw Swales's hands knit together as though in supplication. No gentleman of breeding, he thought almost dreamily, ought to begin a sentence with the unfortunate word but.
"Sir, believe me, I wish that I was wrong. I and the other commanders have done everything to try to accommodate your views, but we cannot. Sir, if you have any love for any of your commanders, we beseech you, think again. Remove me if you feel you must, sir, for having spoken like this. Court-martial me, demote me, execute me, forbid my name, but, sir, reconsider while there is still time."
They sat still, as the car hummed along the road, swerving occasionally for corners, jiggling left, right, or right, left to avoid craters, and we must all look, he thought, as we sit here, frozen in the weak yellow light, like the stiffening dead.
"Stop the car," he heard himself saying.
His finger was already depressing the intercom button. The car rumbled down through the gears and came to a halt. He opened the door. Swales's eyes were closed.
"Get out," he told him.
Swales looked suddenly like an old man hit by the first of many blows. It was as though he had shrunk, collapsed inside. A warm gust of wind threatened to close the door again. He held it open with one hand. Swales bent forward and got slowly out of the car. He stood by the dark roadside for a moment. The cone of light thrown out by the staff car's interior lights swept across his face, then disappeared. Zakalwey locked the door.
"Drive on," he told the driver.
They raced away from the Dawn and the Stabarind before its guns could find and destroy them. They had thought they'd won. In the spring, they'd had more men and more materiel, and in particular, they had more heavy guns. At sea, the Stabarind lurked as a threat, but not a presence, famished of the fuel it needed for effective raids against their forces and convoys, almost more of a liability. But then, Elithiomel had had the great battleship tugged and dredged through the seasonal channels over the ever-changing banks to the empty dry dock, where they'd blasted the extra room and somehow got the ship inside, closed the gates, pumped out the water and pumped in concrete, and, so his advisers had suggested, probably some sort of shock-absorbing cushion between the metal and the concrete, or the half-metre-calibre guns would have shaken the vessel to pieces by now. They suspected Elithiomel had used rubbish, junk to line the sides of his improvised fortress. He found that almost amusing. The Stabarind was not really impregnable, though it was now quite literally unsinkable. It could be taken, but it would exact a terrible price in the taking. And of course, having had their breathing space and time to re-equip, perhaps the forces in and around the ship and the city would break out. That possibility had been discussed too, and Elithiomel was quite capable of it. But whatever he thought about it, however he approached the problem, it always came back to him. The men would do as he asked, the commanders would too, or he'd have them replaced. The politicians and the church had given him a free hand and would back him in anything he did. He felt secure in that, as secure as any commander ever could. But what was he to do? He had expected to inherit a perfectly drilled peacetime army, splendid and impressive, and eventually to hand that over to some other young scion of the court in the same creditable condition, so that the traditions of honour and obedience and duty could be continued. Instead, he found himself at the head of an army going to furious war against an enemy he knew was largely made up of his own countrymen, and commanded by a man he had once thought of as a friend, as well as almost a brother. So he had to give orders that meant men died, and sometimes sacrifice hundreds, thousands of them, knowingly sending them to their near-certain deaths, just to secure some important position or goal, or protect some vital position. And always, whether they liked it or not, the civilians suffered too. The very people they both claimed to be fighting for made up perhaps the bulk of the casualties in their bloody struggle. He had tried to stop it, tried to bargain from the beginning, but neither side wanted peace on anything except its own terms. And he had no real political power, and so had had to fight. His success had amazed him, as it had others, probably not least Alethiamel, but now, poised on the brink of victory, perhaps, he just did not know what to do. More than anything else now, though, he wanted to save Darkonce. He had seen too many dead dry eyes, too much air-blackened blood, too much fly-blown flesh, to be able to relate such ghastly truths to the nebulous ideas of honour and tradition that people claimed they were fighting for. Only the well-being of one loved person seemed really worth fighting for now. It was all that seemed real, all that could save his sanity. To acknowledge the interest millions of other people had in whatever happened here was to place too great a burden on him. It would be to admit, by implication, that he was at least partially responsible for the deaths already of hundreds of thousands, even if nobody else could have fought more humanely. So he waited, held back the commanders and the squadron leaders, and waited for Alethiamel to reply to his signals. The two other commanders said nothing. He put out the lights in the car, unshuttered the doors, and looked out at the dark mass of the forest, racing past under dull dawn skies the colour of steel. They moved past dim bunkers and dark trenches, still figures, stopped trucks, sunken tanks, taped windows, hooded guns, raised poles, grey clearings, wrecked buildings and slitted lamps. All the paraphernalia of the outskirts of the headquarters camp. He watched it all and wished, as they moved closer to the centre, to the old castle that had become his home in all but name over the last couple of months, he wished that he did not have to stop, and could just go on driving through the dawn and the day and the night again forever, cleaving the finely unyielding trees towards nothing and nowhere and no one, even if it was in an icy silence, secure in the nadir of his sufferings, perversely content that at least now they could grow no worse. Just to go on, and never have to stop and make decisions that would not wait, but which might mean he would commit mistakes he could never forget and would never be forgiven for. The car reached the castle courtyard, and he got out. Surrounded by aides, he swept into the grand old house that had once been Alethiamel's HQ. They pestered him with 100 details of logistics and intelligence reports, and skirmishes, and small amounts of ground lost or gained. There were requests from civilians and the foreign press for this and that. He dismissed them all, told the junior commanders to deal with them. He took the stairs to his offices two at a time, handed his jacket and cap to his ADC, and closed himself in his darkened study. His eyes closed, his back against the double doors, the brass handles still clutched in his hands at the small of his back. The quiet, dark room was a balm. "Been out to gaze upon the beast, have you?" He started, then recognised Livueta's voice. He saw her by the windows, a dark figure. He relaxed. "Yes," he said. "Close the drapes." He turned on the room lights. "What are you going to do?" she said, walking slowly closer, her arms folded, her dark hair gathered up, her face troubled. "I don't know," he admitted, going to the desk and sitting. He put his face in his hands and rubbed it. "What would you have me do?" "Talk with him," she said, sitting on the corner of the desk, arms still crossed. She was dressed in a long dark skirt, dark jacket. She was always in dark clothes nowadays. "He won't talk to me," he said, sitting back in the ornate chair he knew the junior officers called his throne. "I can't make him reply." "You can't be saying the right things," she said. "I don't know what to say then," he said, closing his eyes again. "Why don't you compose the next message?" "You wouldn't let me say what I'd want to say. Or if you let me say it, you wouldn't live up to it." "We can't just all lay down our weapons, Livy, and I don't think anything else would work. He wouldn't pay any attention. You could meet face to face. That might be the way to settle things. Livy, the first messenger we sent personally came back without his skin!" He screamed the last word, suddenly losing all patience and control. Liv Waiter flinched and stepped away from the desk. She sat in an ornamental winged couch, her long fingers rubbing at the gold thread sewn into an arm. "I'm sorry," he said quietly. "I didn't mean to shout." "She's our sister, Sheridanin. There must be more we can do." He looked about the room, as though for some fresh inspiration. "Livy, we have been over this and over this and over this. Don't you... can't I get it through? Isn't it clear?" He slapped both hands on the desk. "I am doing all I can. I want her out of there as much as you do, but while he has her, there is just nothing more I can do except attack, and that would probably be the death of her." She shook her head. "What is it between you two?" she asked. "Why won't you talk to each other? How can you forget everything from when we were children?" He shook his head, pushed himself up from the desk, turned to the book-lined wall behind, gaze running over the hundreds of titles without really seeing them. "Oh," he said tiredly, "I haven't forgotten, Liv Waiter." He felt a terrible sadness then, as though the extent of what he felt they had all lost only became real to him when there was somebody else there to acknowledge it. "I haven't forgotten anything." "There must be something else you can do," she insisted. "Liv Waiter, please believe me. There isn't." "I believed you when you told me she was safe and well," the woman said, looking down at the arm of the couch, where her long nails had started to pick at the precious thread. Her mouth was a tight line. "You were ill," he sighed. "What difference does that make? You might have died," he said. He went to the curtains and began straightening them. "Liv Waiter, I couldn't have told you they had Darkle. The shock for this poor, weak woman," Liv Waiter said, shaking her head, still tearing at the threads on the couch arm. "I'd rather you spared me that insulting nonsense than spare me the truth about my own sister." "I was only trying to do what was best," he told her, starting towards her, then stopping, retreating to the corner of the desk where she had sat. "I'm sure," she said laconically. "The habit of taking responsibility comes with your exalted position, I suppose. I am expected to be grateful, no doubt. Livy, please, must I what?" She looked at him, eyes sparkling. "Must I make life difficult for you?" "Yes." "All I want," he said slowly, trying to control himself, "is for you to try and understand. We need to stick together, to support each other right now." "You mean I have to support you, even though you won't support Darkle?" Liv Waiter said. "Damn it, Livy!" he shouted. "I am doing my best! There isn't just her. There's a lot of other people I have to worry about. All my men, the civilians in the city, the whole damn country." He went forward to her, knelt in front of the winged couch, put his hand on the same arm that her long-nailed hand picked at. "Liv Waiter, please. I am doing all it is possible to do. Help me in this. Back me up. The other commanders want to attack. I'm all there is between Darkans and..." "Maybe you should attack," she said suddenly. "Maybe that's the one thing he isn't expecting." He shook his head. "He has her in the ship. We'd have to destroy that before we can take the city." He looked her in the eye. "Do you trust him not to kill her, even if she isn't killed in the attack?" "Yes," Liv Waiter said. "Yes, I do." He held her gaze for a while, certain that she would recant, or at least look away. But she just kept looking straight back at him. "Well," he said eventually, "I can't take that risk." He sighed, closing his eyes, resting his head against the arm of the couch. "There's so much pressure on me." He tried to take her hand, but she pulled it away. "Liv Waiter, don't you think I feel? Don't you think I care about what happens to Darkle? Do you think that I'm not still the brother you knew, as well as the soldier they made me? Do you think that because I have an army to do my bidding, and ADCs and junior officers to obey every whim, I don't get lonely?" She stood up suddenly, without touching him. "Yes," she said, looking down at him, while he looked at the threads of gold on the couch arm. "You are lonely, and I am lonely, and D'Arcance is lonely, and he is lonely, and everybody is lonely." She turned quickly, the long skirt briefly belling, and walked to the door and out. He heard the doors slam, and stayed where he was, kneeling in front of the abandoned couch like some rejected suitor. He pushed his smallest finger through a loop in the gold thread Livueta had teased from the couch arm, and pulled at it until it burst. He got up slowly, walked to the window, slipped through the drapes, and stood looking out at the grey dawn. Men and machines moved through the vague wisps of mist, grey skeins like nature's own gauzy camouflage nets. He envied the men he could see. He was sure most of them envied him in return. He was in control. He had the soft bed and did not have to tread through trench mud or deliberately stub his toes against rocks to keep awake on guard duty. But he envied them nevertheless, because they only had to do what they were told. And, he admitted to himself, he envied Alethiamel. Would that he were more like him, he thought all too often, to have that ruthless cunning, that extemporizing guile. He wanted that. He slunk back through the drapes, guilty at the thought. At the desk, he turned the room lights off and sat back in the seat. His throne, he thought, and for the first time in days, laughed a little, because it was such an image of power, and he felt so utterly powerless. He heard a truck draw up outside the window where it was not supposed to. He sat still, suddenly thinking, a massive bomb, just out there, and was suddenly terrified. He heard a sergeant barking, some talk, and then the truck moved a little way off, though he could still hear its engine. After a while, he heard raised voices in the hall stairwell. There was something about the tone of the voices that chilled him. He tried to tell himself he was being foolish and turned all the lights back on, but he could still hear them. Then there was something like a scream cut off abruptly. He shook. He unholstered his pistol, wishing he had something more lethal than this slim little dress uniform gun. He went to the door. The voices sounded odd. Some were raised, while some people were apparently trying to keep theirs quiet. He opened the door a crack, then went through. His ADC was at the far door onto the stairs, looking down. He put the pistol back in his holster. He walked out to join the ADC and followed his gaze down into the hall. He saw Livueta staring wide-eyed back up at him. There were a few other soldiers, one of the other commanders. They stood round a small white chair. He frowned. Livueta looked upset. He went quickly down the steps. Livueta suddenly came bounding up to meet him, skirt hem flying. She pushed into him, both hands against his chest. He staggered back, amazed. "No," she said. Her eyes were bright and staring. Her face looked more pale than he'd ever seen. "Go back," she said. Her voice sounded thick, like it was not her own. "Livueta," he said, annoyed, and pushed himself away from the wall, trying to glance round her at whatever was happening in the hall round the little white chair. She pushed him again. "Go back," the thick, strange voice said. He took her wrists in his hands. "Livueta," he said, voice low, eyes flicking to indicate the people standing beneath in the hall. "Go back," the strange, terrifying voice said. He pushed her away, annoyed at her, tried to go past her. She attempted to grab him from behind. "Back," she gasped. "Livueta, stop this." He shook her off, embarrassed now. He clattered quickly down the steps before she could grab him again. Still, she threw herself down after him, clutched at his waist. "Go back," she wailed. He turned round. "Get off me! I want to see what's going on!" He was stronger than her. He tore her arms free, threw her down on the stairs. He went down, walked across the flagstones to where the silent group of men stood round the little white chair. It was very small. It looked so delicate that an adult might have broken it. It was small and white. And as he took a couple of more paces forwards, as the rest of the people and the hall and the castle and the world and the universe disappeared into the darkness and the silence, and he came closer and slowly closer to the chair, he saw that it had been made out of the bones of D'Arcance Zakalwe. Femora, formed the back legs, tibiae, and some other bones the front. Arm bones made the seat frame, the ribs were the back. Beneath them was the pelvis that had been shattered years earlier in the stone boat, its bone fragments rejoined, the darker material the surgeons had used quite visible too. Above the ribs, there was the collarbone, also broken and healed, memoir of a riding accident. They had tanned her skin and made a little cushion out of it, a tiny plain button in her navel, and at one corner, just the hint, the start of some dark but slightly red-tinged hair. There were stairs and Liv Waiter and the ADC and the ADC's office between there and here, he found himself thinking, as he stood at his desk again. He tasted blood in his mouth, looked down at his right hand. He seemed to recall having punched Liv Waiter on his way up the stairs. What a terrible thing to do to one's own sister. He looked about, distracted for a moment. Everything looked blurred. Intending to rub his eyes, he raised one hand and found the pistol in it. He put it to his right temple. This was, of course, he realized, exactly what Alethea Mel wanted him to do. But then, what chance did one have against such a monster? There was only so much a man could take, after all. He smiled at the doors. Somebody was thumping on them, calling out a word that might have been his name. He couldn't remember now. So silly. Doing the right thing. The only way out. The honourable exit. What a load of nonsense. Just despair. Just the last laugh to have. Opening a mouth through the bone to confront the world direct. Here. But such consummate skill, such ability, such adaptability, such numbing ruthlessness, such a use of weapons, when anything could become weapon. His hand was shaking. He could see the doors starting to give way. Somebody must be hitting them very hard. He supposed he must have locked them. There was nobody else in the room. He ought to have chosen a bigger gun, he realized. This one might not be big enough to do the job. His mouth was very dry. He pressed the gun hard against his temple and pulled the trigger. The besieged forces round the Stabberind broke out within the hour, while the surgeons were still fighting for his life. It was a good battle, and they nearly won. Chapter 14.
The Calway?
No.
Still the same refusal. They stood in a park at the edge of a large, neatly mown lawn, under some tall, pollarded trees. The warm breeze carried the ocean scent and a hint of flowers, whispering through the copse. The clearing morning mist still veiled two suns. Smar shook her head in exasperation and walked off a little way. He leant against a tree, clutching at his chest, breathing with difficulty. Scaffan Amtiscor hovered nearby, keeping a watch on the man, but playing with an insect on the trunk of another tree. Scaffan Amtiscor thought the man was mad. Certainly he was weird. He had never really explained why he'd gone wandering through the mayhem of the Citadel storming. When Smar and the drone had finally found him and picked him up, bullet-riddled, half-dead, and raving from the top of the curtain wall, he had insisted they stabilize his condition, no more. He did not want to be made well. He would not listen to sense, and still the xenophobe, when it had picked them all up, had refused to pronounce the man insane and incapable of making up his own mind, and so had dutifully put him into a low-metabolism sleep for the 15-day journey to the planet where the woman called Livweta Zakalwe now lived. He'd come out of his slow sleep, as ill as he'd gone into it. The man was a walking mess, and there were still two bullets inside him, but he refused to accept any treatment until he'd seen this woman. Bizarre, Scaffan Amtiscor thought, using an extended field to block the path of a small insect as it felt and picked its way up the trunk of the tree. The insect changed direction, feelers waving. There was another type of insect further up the trunk, and Scaffan Amtiscor was trying to get them to meet to see what would happen. Bizarre, and even, indeed, perverse.
Okay, he coughed.
One lung, the drone knew, filling up with blood.
Let's go.
He pushed himself away from the tree. Scaffan Amtiscor abandoned its game with the two insects regretfully. The drone felt odd being here. The planet was known about, but had not yet been fully investigated by contact. It had been discovered through research rather than physical exploration, and, while there was nothing obviously outlandish about the place, and a very rudimentary survey had been carried out, technically it was still terra incognita, and Scaffin Antiscor was on a relatively high state of alert, just in case the place held any nasty surprises. Smar went to the bald-headed man and put her arm round his waist, helping to support him. Together, they walked up the small slope of lawn towards a low ridge. Scaffin Antiscor watched them go from the cover of the treetops, then swooped slowly down towards them as they walked to the summit of the gentle slope. The man staggered when he saw what was on the far side in the distance. The drone suspected he would have fallen to the grass if Smar hadn't been there to hold him up.
Shit, he breathed, and tried to straighten,
blinking in a sudden slant of sunlight as the mists continued to evaporate. He stumbled another couple of steps, shook Smar off, and turned round once, taking in the parkland, shaped trees and manicured lawns, ornamental walls and delicate pergolas, stone-bordered ponds and shady paths through quiet groves. And in the distance, set amongst mature trees, the tattered black shape of the Stabberrind.
They've made a fucking park out of it, he breathed,
and stood swaying, bent slightly at the waist, looking at the battered silhouette of the old warship. Smar walked to his side. He seemed to sag a little, and she put her arm round his waist again. He grimaced with pain. They walked on, down towards a path which led to the ship.
Why did you want to see this, Sharadanin?
Smar said quietly, as they crunched along the gravel. The drone floated behind and above.
Hmm?
The man said, taking his eyes off the ship for a second.
Why did you want to come here, Sharadanin? Smar asked. She isn't here. This isn't where she is.
I know, he breathed. I know that.
So why do you want to see this wreck?
He was silent for a little while. It was as though he hadn't heard. But then he took a deep breath, flinching with pain as he did so, and shook his sweat-sheened head as he said,
Oh, just for old time's sake.
They passed through another copse of trees. He shook his shaved head again as they came out of the grove and saw the ship better.
I just didn't think they'd do this to it, he said.
Do what? Smar asked.
This.
He nodded at the blackened hulk.
What have they done, Sharadanin? Smar asked patiently.
Made it,
he began, then stopped, coughed, body tense with pain.
Made the damn thing an ornament. Preserved it.
What? The ship?
He looked at her as though she were crazy.
Yes, he said. Yes, the ship.
Just a big old battleship hulk cemented into a dock as far as Scaffin Antiscor could see. It contacted the xenophobe, which was passing the time by making a detailed map of the planet.
Hello, ship. This ship ruin in the park. Sir Calway seems very interested. Just wondering why. Care to do some research?
In a while. I've still got one continent, the deep sea beds, and the subsurface to do.
They'll still be there later. This could prove interesting now.
Patience, Scaffin Antiscor.
Pedant, thought the drone, breaking off.
The two humans walked down twisty paths past litter bins and benches, picnic tables and information points. Scaffin Antiscor activated one of the old information points as it passed. A slow and crackly tape started up.
The vessel you see before you...
This was going to take ages, Scaffin Antiscor thought. It used its effector to speed the machine up, winding the voice up into a high-pitched warble. The tape broke. Scaffin Antiscor delivered the effector equivalent of an annoyed slap and left the information machine smoking and dripping burning plastic onto the gravel beneath as the two humans walked into the shadow of the battered ship. The ship had been left as it was, bombed, shelled, strafed, blasted and ripped, but not destroyed. Where hands could not reach and rain did not strike, traces of the original soot from flames 2 centuries old still marked the armour plate. Gun turrets lay peeled open like tin cans. Gun barrels and rangefinders bristled askew all over the mounting levels of deck. Tangled stays and fallen aerials lay strewn over shattered searchlights and lopsided radar dishes. The single great funnel looked tipped and subsided, metal pitted and flayed. A little awning-covered stairway led up to the ship's main deck. They followed a couple with two young children. Scaffin Amtiskor floated, almost invisible, 10 meters away, rising slowly with them. One of the toddlers cried when she saw the hobbling, bald-headed man with the staring eyes behind her. Her mother lifted her up and carried her. He had to stop and rest when they got to the deck. Smar guided him to a bench. He sat doubled up for a while, then looked at the ship above, taking in the blackened, rusted wreckage all around. He shook his shaven head, muttered to himself once, then ended up laughing quietly, holding his chest and coughing.
"Museum," he said. "Museum."
Smar put a hand on his damp brow. She thought he looked terrible, and the baldness didn't suit him. The simple dark clothes they'd found him wearing when they picked him up from the Citadel's curtain wall had been torn and crusted with blood. They'd been cleaned and repaired on the Xenophobe, but they looked out of place here, where everybody seemed to be dressed in bright colours. Even Smar's culottes and jacket were sombre compared to the gaily decorated dresses and smocks most of the people were wearing.
"This an old haunt of yours, Sharadanin?" she asked him.
He nodded.
"Yes," he breathed,
looking up at the last few tendrils of mist flowing and disappearing like gaseous pennants from the tilted mainmast.
"Yes," he repeated.
Smar looked round at the park behind and the city off to one side.
"This where you came from?"
He seemed not to hear. After a while, he stood slowly and looked distracted into Smar's eyes. She felt herself shiver and tried to remember exactly how old Zakalwe was.
"Let's go, Dizit."
He smiled, a watery sort of smile.
"Take me to her, please."
Smar shrugged and supported the man by one shoulder. They went back to the steps that led back down to the ground.
"Drone,"
Smar said to a brooch on her lapel.
"Yep."
"Our lady's still where we last heard?"
"Indeed," said the drone's voice. "Want to take the module?"
"No,"
he said, stumbling down a stair until Smar caught him.
"Not the module. Let's take a train or a cab or..."
"You sure?" Smar said.
"Yes, sure."
"Zakalwe," Smar sighed. "Please accept some treatment."
"No,"
the man said as they reached the ground.
"There's an underground station right and right again," the drone told Smar. "A light central station, platform 8 for trains to Kuraz."
"Okay," Smar said reluctantly, glancing at him.
He was looking down at the gravel path, as though concentrating on working out which foot to put in front of another. He swung his head as they passed under the stem of the ruined battleship, squinting up at the tall, curving V of the bows. Smar watched the expression on his sweating face, and could not decide whether it was awe, disbelief, or something like terror. The underground train whisked them into the city centre, down concrete-lined tunnels. The main station was crowded, tall, echoing and clean. Sunlight sparkled on the vault of the arched glass roof. Scaffin Amtiskor had done its suitcase impression and sat lightly in Smar's hand. The wounded man was a heavier weight on her other arm. The maglev train drew in, disgorged its passengers. They boarded with a few other people.
"You going to make it, Sharadanin?" Smar asked him.
He was slumped in the seat, resting his arms on the table in a way that, somehow, made them look as though they were broken or paralysed. He stared at the seat across from him, ignoring the cityscape as it slid by, the train accelerating along viaducts towards the suburbs and the countryside. He nodded.
"I'll survive."
"Yes, but for how much longer?" said the drone, sitting on the table in front of Smar. "You are in terrible shape, Zakalwe."
"Better than looking like a suitcase," he said, glancing at the machine.
"Oh, how droll," the machine said. "You finished drawing things yet?" it asked the xenophobe.
"No."
"Can't you devote just a little of your supposedly bogglingly fast mind to finding out why he was so interested in that ship?"
"Oh, I suppose so, but..."
"Wait a minute. What have we here? Listen to this."
"You'll find out, I suppose. Past time, I told you,"
he said, looking out of the window but talking to Smar. The city slid by beyond, bright in the sunlight. His eyes were wide, pupils dilated, and somehow Smar got the impression he was looking at one city, but seeing another. Or seeing the same one, but long ago, as though in some time-polarized light only his distressed and fevered eyes could see.
"This is where you come from?"
"Long time ago now,"
he said, coughing, doubling up, holding one arm tight to his side. He took a long, slow breath.
"I was born here."
The woman listened. The drone listened. The ship listened. While he told them the story of the great house that lay halfway between the mountains and the sea, upstream from the great city. He told them about the estate surrounding the house, and the beautiful gardens, and about the three, later four, children who were brought up in the house and who played in the garden. He told them about the summer houses, and the stone boat, and the maze, and the fountains, and the lawns, and the ruins, and the animals in the woods. He told them about the two boys, and the two girls, and the two mothers, and the one strict father, and the one unseen father imprisoned in the city. He told them about the visits to the city, which the children always thought lasted too long, and about the time when they were no longer allowed to go into the garden without guards to escort them, and about how they stole a gun one day, and were going to take it out into the estate to shoot it, but only got as far as the stone boat, and surprised an assassination squad come to kill the family, and save the day by alerting the house. He told them about the bullet that hit D'Arconce, and the sliver of her bone that pierced him almost to his heart. He started to dry up, voice croaking. Smar saw a waiter pushing a trolley into the far end of the coach. She bought a couple of soft drinks. He gulped at first, but coughed painfully, and then just sipped his.
"And the war did start," he said,
looking at, but not seeing, the last of the suburbs flow past. The countryside was a green blur as they accelerated again,
and the two boys that had become men ended up on different sides.
"Fascinating,"
the xenophobe communicated to Scaffinaptiscor.
"I think I will do a little quick research."
"About time, too," the drone sent back,
listening to the man talk at the same time. He told them about the war, and the siege that involved the Stabberind, and the besieged forces breaking out. And he told them about the man, the boy who'd played in the garden, who in the depths of one terrible night had caused the thing to be done which led him to being called the Chairmaker. And the dawn when D'Arconce's sister and brother had found what Alethiamel had done. And the brother trying to take his own life, giving up his generalship, abandoning the armies and his sister in the selfishness of despair. And he told them about Livueta, who had never forgiven, and had followed him, though he did not know it at the time, on another cold ship, for a century through the intractable calm slowness of real space, to a place where the icebergs swirled round a continental pole, forever carving and crashing and shrinking. But then she had lost him, the trail gone appropriately cold, and she had stayed there, searching for years, and could not have known that he had left for another life entirely, taken away by the tall lady who walked through the blizzard as though it wasn't there, a small spaceship at her back like a faithful pet. And so Livueta Zakalwe gave up, and took another long journey to get away from the burden of her memories. And where she had ended up, the ship quizzed the drone for the location. Scaffinaptiscor gave it the name of the planet in the system a few decades away. That had been where she'd finally been tracked down after his last job for them. Scaffinaptiscor remembered. The grey-haired woman in her early late years, working in a clinic in the slums. A delicate shanty town, strewn like trash across the mud and tree-lined slopes above a tropical city, looking out across sparkling lagoons and golden sandbars to the rollers of a vast ocean. Thin, marks under her eyes, a pot-bellied child on each hip when they first went to see her, standing in the middle of the crowded room, wailing children tugging at her hems. The drone had learned to appreciate the full range of pan-human facial expressions and thought that, in witnessing the one that appeared on Livueta Zakalwe's face when she saw Zakalwe, it had experienced something close to unique. Such surprise, but such hatred.
"Sharadanin,"
Smar said tenderly, gently laying one hand on his. She put her other hand to the nape of his neck, stroking him there as his head bent lower to the table. He turned and watched the prairie stream past like a sea of gold. He put one hand up, smoothing it slowly over his brow and shaved scalp, as though through long hair. Kuraz had been everything. Ice and fire, land and water. Once the broad isthmus had been a place of rock and glaciers, then a land of forests, as the world and its continents shifted and the climate altered. Later it became a desert, but then suffered something beyond the capacity of the globe itself to provide. An asteroid, the size of a mountain, hit the isthmus like a bullet striking flesh. It burst into the granite heart of the land, ringing the planet like a bell. Two oceans met for the first time. The dust of the immense explosion blocked out the sun, started a small ice age, wiped out thousands of species. The ancestors of the species that later came to rule the planet took their initial opportunity from that cataclysm. The crater became a dome as the planet reacted over the millennia. The oceans were separated again when the rocks, even the seemingly solid layers flowing and warping over those great scales of time and distance, pushed back, like an eons-late bruise forming on the skin of the world. Smar had found the information brochure in a seat pocket. She looked up from it for a moment at the man in the seat beside her. He'd fallen asleep. His face looked drawn and grey and old. She could not remember ever having seen him look so ancient and ill. Damn it, he looked healthier when he'd been beheaded.
Sir Calway, she whispered, shaking her head. What's wrong with you?
Death wish, the drone muttered quietly, with extrovert complications.
Smar shook her head and went back to the brochure. The man slept fitfully, and the drone monitored him. Reading about Kuraz, Smar suddenly recalled the great fortress she'd been picked up from by the xenophobe's module on a sunny day that now seemed as long ago as it was far away. She looked up, sighing, from a photograph of the isthmus taken from space, and thought back to the house under the dam, and felt homesick. Kuraz had been a fortified town, a prison, a fortress, a city, a target. Now, perhaps appropriately, Smar thought, looking at the injured, shivering man at her side, the great dome of rock held a small city that was mostly taken up with the biggest hospital in the world. The train hurtled into a tunnel carved from naked rock. They passed through the station, took an elevator to one of the hospital reception levels. They sat on a couch surrounded by potted plants and soft music, while the drone, sitting on the floor at their feet, plundered the nearest computer workstation for information.
Got her, it announced quietly. Go to the receptionist and tell her your name. I've ordered you a pass. No verification required.
Come on, Sir Calway.
Smar rose, collected her pass, and helped him to his feet. He staggered.
Look, she said. Sheradinin, let me at...
Just take me to her.
Let me talk to her first.
No. Take me to her, now.
The ward was up another few levels in the sunlight. The light came through clear, high windows. The sky was white with scudding cloud outside, and way in the distance, beyond the dappled fields and woodland, the ocean was a line of blue haze beneath the sky. Old men lay quietly in the broad, partitioned ward. Smar helped him towards the far end, where the drone said Livueta must be. They entered a short, broad corridor. Livueta came out of a side room. She stopped when she saw them. Livueta Zakalwe looked older, white-haired, skin soft and lined with age. Her eyes were undulled. She drew herself up a little. She was holding a deep-sided tray full of little boxes and bottles. Livueta looked at them. The man, the woman, the little pale suitcase that was the drone. Smar glanced to one side, hissed, Zakalwe. She hauled him more upright. His eyes had been shut. They blinked open, and he squinted uncertainly at the woman standing in front of them. He appeared not to recognize her at first. Then, slowly, understanding seemed to filter through.
Livy?
He said, blinking quickly, squinting at her.
Livy?
Hello, Miss Zakalwe, Smar said, when the woman did not reply.
Livueta Zakalwe turned contemptuous eyes from the man, half hanging from Smar's right arm. She looked at Smar and shook her head, so that just for an instant, Smar thought she was going to say no, she wasn't Livueta.
Why do you keep doing this?
Livueta Zakalwe said softly. Her voice was still young, the drone thought, just as the xenophobe came back with some fascinating information it had gleaned from historical records.
Really? The drone signaled. Dead?
Why do you do this? She said. Why do you do this to him? To me? Why? Can't you just leave us all alone?
Smar shrugged a little awkwardly.
Livy, he said.
I'm sorry, Miss Zakalwe, Smar said. It's what he wanted, we promised.
Livy, please, talk to me.
You shouldn't do this, Livueta told Smar.
Then she turned her gaze to the man, who was rubbing one hand over his shaved scalp, grinning inanely at her, blinking.
"He looks sick," she said flatly.
"He is," Smar said.
"Bring him in here."
Livweta Zakalwe opened another door, a room with a bed. Scaffin Amtiskor, still wondering exactly what was going on in the light of the information it had just received from the ship, still found the time to be mildly surprised that the woman was taking it all so calmly this time. Last time she'd tried to kill the fellow, and it had had to move in smartly.
"I don't want to lie down,"
he protested when he saw the bed.
"Then just sit, Sharadanin," Smar said.
Livweta Zakalwe made a shaking motion with her head, muttered something even the drone could not make out. She placed the tray of drugs down on a table, stood in one corner of the room, arms crossed, while the man sat down on the bed.
"I'll leave you alone," Smar said to the woman. "We'll be just outside."
"Close enough for me to hear," thought the drone, "and to stop her trying to murder you again, if that's what she decides to do."
"No,"
the woman said, shaking her head, looking with an odd dispassion at the man on the bed.
"No, don't leave. There's nothing..."
"But I want them to leave,"
he said, and coughed, doubling over and almost falling off the bed. Smar went to help him and pulled him a little further onto the bed.
"What can't you say in front of them?" Livweta Zakalwe asked.
"What don't they know?" "I just want to have a talk in private. Livy, please," he said, looking up at her.
"Please, I have nothing to say to you, and there is nothing you can say to me."
The drone heard somebody in the corridor outside. There was a knock at the door. Livweta opened it. A young female nurse who called Livweta's sister told her that it was time to prepare one of the patients. Livweta Zakalwe looked at her watch.
"I have to go," she told them.
"Livy! Livy, please!"
He leant forward on the bed, both elbows tight by his sides, both hands clawed out, palm up in front of him.
"Please!"
There were tears in his eyes.
"This is pointless."
The old woman shook her head.
"And you are a fool."
She looked at Smar.
"Don't bring him to me again."
"Livy!"
He collapsed on the bed, curled up and quivering. The drone sensed heat from the shaven head, could see blood vessels throb on his neck and hands.
"Sharadanin, it's all right," Smar said, going to the bed and down on one knee, taking his shoulders in her hands.
There was a crack as one of Livweta Zakalwe's hands thumped down into the top of a table she stood beside. The man wept, shaking. The drone sensed odd brainwave patterns. Smar looked up at the woman.
"Don't call him that,"
Livweta Zakalwe said.
"Don't call him what?" Smar said. Smar could be pretty thick, the drone thought.
"Don't call him Sharadanin."
"Why not?"
"It isn't his name."
"It isn't?"
Smar looked mystified. The drone monitored the man's brain activity and blood flow and thought there was trouble coming.
"No, it isn't."
"But,"
Smar began.
She shook her head suddenly.
"He's your brother. He's Sharadanin Zakalwe." "No, Miss Smar,"
Livweta Zakalwe said, taking the drug tray up again and opening the door with one hand.
"No, he isn't."
"Aneurysm," the drone said quickly, and slipped through the air past Smar to the bed, where the man was shaking spastically. It scanned him more thoroughly, found a massive blood vessel leakage pouring into the man's brain. It whirled him round, straightened him out, using its effector to make him unconscious. Inside his brain, the blood continued to pump through the tear into the surrounding tissue, invading the cortex.
"Sorry about this, ladies," the drone said.
It produced a cutting field and sliced through his skull. He stopped breathing. Scaffin Amtiskor used another aspect of its force field to keep his chest moving in and out, while its effector gently persuaded the muscles that opened his lungs to work again. It took the top of his skull off. A quick, low-powered crew blast, mirrored off another field component, cauterized all the appropriate blood vessels. It held his skull to one side. Blood was already visible, welling through the folded grey geography of the man's brain tissue. His heart stopped. The drone kept it going with its effector. Both women had stopped, fascinated and appalled at the actions of the machine. It stripped away the layers of the man's brain with its own senses, cortex, limbic, thalamus, cerebellum. It moved through his defences and armaments, down his thoroughfares and ways, through the stores and the lands of his memories, searching and mapping and tapping and searing.
"What do you mean?"
Smar said, in an almost dreamlike way, to the elderly woman just about to quit the room.
What do you mean, no? What do you mean he isn't your brother?
I mean he is not Sharadanin Zakalwe. Livueta sighed, watching the drone's bizarre operation upon the man.
She was...
Smar found herself frowning into the woman's face.
What, then?
Go back. Go right back. What was I to do? Go back. The point is to win. Go back. Everything must bend to that truth.
Sharadanin Zakalwe, my brother, Livueta Zakalwe said, died nearly 200 years ago. Died not long after he received the bones of our sister made into a chair.
The drone sucked the blood from the man's brain, teasing a hollow field filament through the broken tissue, collecting the red fluid in a little transparent bulb. A second filament tube spun knit the torn tissue back together. It sucked more blood to decrease the man's blood pressure, used its effector to alter the settings in the appropriate glands, so that the pressure would not grow so great again for a while. It sent a narrow tube of field over to a small sink under the window, jetting the excess blood down the drain hole, then briefly turning on the tap. The blood flushed away, gurgling.
The man you know as Sharadanin Zakalwe.
Facing it by facing it. That's all I ever did. Stabberind. Zakalwe. The name's hurt, but how else could I?
It's the man who took my brother's name, just as he took my brother's life, just as he took my sister's life.
But she...
He was the commander of the Stabberind. He is the chairmaker. He is Alethiamel.
Livueta Zakalwe walked out, closing the door behind her. Smar turned, face almost bloodless, to look at the body of the man lying on the bed. While Skaffin Amtiskor worked on, engrossed in its struggle to make good. Epilogue. Dust, as usual, followed them, though the young man said several times he thought it might rain. The old man disagreed and said the clouds over the mountains were deceptive. They drove on through the deserted lands, past blackened fields and the shells of cottages and the ruins of farms, and the burned villages and the still smoking towns, until they came to the abandoned city. In the city, they drove resoundingly through the wide, empty streets, and once took the vehicle crashing and careering up a narrow alley, crammed with bare market stalls and rickety poles supporting tattered shade cloths, demolishing it all in a fine welter of splintering wood and wildly flapping fabric. They chose the Royal Park as the best place to plant the bomb, because the troops could be comfortably accommodated in the park's wide spaces, and the High Command would likely take to the grand pavilions. The old man thought that they'd want to occupy the palace, but the young man was convinced that in their hearts the invaders were desert people and would prefer the spaces of the park to the clutter of the citadel. So they planted the bomb in the great pavilion and armed it. And then they argued about whether they'd done the right thing. They argued about where to wait things out and what to do if the army ignored the city altogether and just went on by, and whether after the prospective event the other armies would retire in terror or split up into smaller units to continue the invasion. Or know the weapon used had been unique, and so maintained their steady progress, doubtless in an even more ruthless spirit of vengeance than before. They argued about whether the invaders would bombard the city first, or send in scouts, and, if they did shell, where they would target. They had a bet on that. About the only thing they agreed on was that what they were doing was a waste of the one nuke their side, indeed either side, possessed. Because, even if they had guessed correctly, and the invaders behaved as they'd anticipated, the most they could hope to do was wipe out one army, and that would still leave three more, any one of which could probably complete the invasion. So the warhead, like the lives, would be wasted. They radioed their superiors, and with a code word, told them what they had done. After a little while, they received the blessing of the High Command in the form of another single word. Their masters didn't really believe the weapon would work. The older man was called Cullis, and he won the argument about where they ought to wait, and so they settled into their high, grand citadel, and found lots of weapons and wine and got drunk, and talked, and told jokes and swapped outrageous stories of derring do and conquest. And at one point, one of them asked the other what happiness was, and received a fairly flippant reply, but later, neither could remember which one had asked and which one had answered.
They slept, and they woke, and they got drunk again, and they told more jokes and lies, and a light shower of rain blew softly over the city at one point. And sometimes the young man would move his hand over his shaved head, through long, thick hair that was not there anymore. Still they waited, and when the first shells started to fall, they found they'd picked the wrong place to wait, and so in scrambling out of it, down the steps and into the courtyard, and into the half-track, and then away out into the desert and the wasteland beyond, where they camped at dusk and got drunk again, and stayed up specially that night to watch the flash.
Zakalwe's song. Watching from the room as the troops go by. You ought to be able to tell, I think, where they're going or coming back by just leaving the gaps in the ranks.
You are a fool, I said, and turned to leave. Or maybe only mix a drink for that deft throat to swallow like all my finest lies.
I faced into the shadows of things. You leant against the window, gazing at nothing.
When are we going to leave?
We could get stuck here, caught, if we try to stay too long. Turning.
Why don't we leave?
I said nothing, stroked a cracked glass, exclusive knowledge in the silence. The bomb lives only as it is falling.
Shias Engin, Complete Collected Works, Posthumous Edition, Month 18, 355th Great Year, Stala Prophetician Calendar. Volume 9, Juvenilia and Discarded Drafts.
States of War.
Prologue. The path up to the highest cultivation terrace followed an extravagantly zigzag route to allow the wheelchairs to cope with the gradient. It took him 6.5 minutes of hard work to get to the highest terrace. He was sweating when he got there, but he had beaten his previous record, and so he was pleased. His breath smoked in the cold air as he undid the heavy quilted jacket and wheeled the chair along to one of the raised beds. He lifted the basket out of his lap and balanced it on the retaining wall, took the cutters from his jacket pocket and looked carefully at the selection of small plants, trying to gauge which cuttings had fared best since their planting. He hadn't chosen the first one when some movement upslope attracted his attention. He looked through the high fence to the dark green forest. The distant peaks were white against the blue sky above. At first, he thought it was an animal. Then the figure moved out of the trees and walked over the frost-whitened grass towards the gate in the fence. The woman opened the gate, closed it behind her. She wore a thin-looking coat and trousers. He was mildly surprised to see that she didn't have a rucksack. Perhaps she'd walked up through the grounds of the Institute earlier and was now returning. A visiting doctor, maybe. He had been going to wave if she looked at him, as she took the steps down to the Institute buildings. But she left the gate and walked straight towards him. She was tall, dark hair and a light brown face under a curious-looking fur hat.
"Mr. Escueria," she said, extending a hand.
He put down the cutters, shook her hand.
"Good morning, Miss..."
She didn't reply, but sat down on the wall, clapped ungloved hands together, looked around the valley, at the mountains and the forest, the river and the Institute buildings downslope.
"How are you, Mr. Escueria? Are you well?"
He looked down at what was left of his legs, amputated above the knees.
"What is left of me is well, ma'am."
It had become his usual reply. He knew it might sound bitter to some people, but really it was his way of showing he did not want to pretend that there was nothing wrong with him. She looked at the trousered stumps with a frankness he had only known before from children.
"It was a tank, wasn't it?"
"Yes," he said, taking up the clippers again. "Tried to trip it up on the way to Balzite City. Didn't work."
He leant over, took a cutting and placed it in the basket. He made a note of which plant he'd taken it from and attached it to the twig.
"Excuse me."
He moved the wheelchair along a little, and the woman got out of his way as he took another cutting. She stepped round in front of him again.
"Story I heard said you were dragging one of your comrades out of its..."
"Yes," he interrupted. "Yes, that's the story. Of course, I didn't know then the price of charity is developing extremely strong arm muscles."
"You get your medal yet?"
She squatted down on her haunches, putting one of her hands on a wheel of his chair. He looked at the hand, then at her face, but she just grinned. He opened his quilted jacket, showed the uniform tunic underneath with all its ribbons.
"Yes, I got my medal."
He ignored her hand, pushed the chair along again.
The woman rose, squatted down again beside him. Impressive display for one so young. Surprised you weren't promoted faster. Is it true you didn't show the right attitude to your superiors? That why he threw the clippers down in the basket, wheeled the chair round to face her.
Yeah, lady, he sneered. I said the wrong things. My family never were very well connected, even when they were alive. And now they're not even that, thanks to the Imperial Glacine Air Force and these.
He clutched at the chest of the tunic, hauling at the metal ribbons, brandishing them.
These I'd trade you. All of them for a pair of shoes I could wear. Now.
He leant forward at her, took up the clippers.
I have work to do. There's a guy down in the Institute who stepped on a mine. He hasn't got any legs at all, and he lost an arm. Maybe you'd find it even more fun to go and patronize him. Excuse me.
He whirled the chair around, moved off a few meters, and took a couple of cuttings, tearing at two plants almost at random. He heard the woman on the path behind him and put his hands on the wheels, pushing himself away. She stopped him. Her hand held the back of the wheelchair, and she was stronger than she looked. His arms strained against the wheels. The rubber buzzed against the stone path, wheels turning but not propelling him anywhere. He relaxed, looked up at the sky. She came round in front of him, squatted down again. He sighed.
What exactly do you want, lady?
You, Mr. Escoeria. The woman smiled her beautiful smile. She nodded at the stumps. By the way, the deal with the medals and the shoes? Fair enough. She shrugged. Except you can keep the medals. She reached into the basket, took out the clippers and stuck them into the earth under the plants, then put her hands, clasped, on the front of the seat. Now, Mr. Escoeria, Smar said, shivering, how would you like a proper job?
This has been an Ashet Digital production of Use of Weapons, written by Ian M. Banks and read by Peter Kenny. Produced and directed by Talking Issues. Text copyright Ian M. Banks, 1990. Production copyright Ashet Digital, 2011.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.